Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Emergency Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome our speaker for today, RCVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, soft tissue, Daniela Murguia. Thank you, Daniela. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much for being here. I'm going to start the talk of today with a flow chart that I have done to show the steps that we usually use to do a proper diagnostic workup in case of respiratory emergencies. In fact, in presence of respiratory emergency, stabilization and workup in order to obtain a diagnosis must be prompt. The diagnostic workup varies, obviously, depending on whether the upper or the lower respiratory tract is involved. And as you can see from this flow chart, the very first important step is obviously provide oxygen and try to have a venous access. And then, depending on how the animal presents, usually they are dyspneic and they cannot get air. So we might find providing of a sedation very advantageous. If we do suspect that there is an issue with the upper airways, probably we will need to GA the patient to be able to examine the oral cavity and see if there is any kind of obstruction at that level, and also to have a look at deeper at the level of the larynx, for example, in case of laryngeal paralysis or in Boas dogs, to have a look at the soft palate. And then we might consider to either do X-rays and endoscopy or CT scan, depending on the case. If we are dealing with the lower airways, so this is something where we might need to do X-rays of the neck and the chest, but we need to keep in mind the risk that we the risk of collapsing and to lose our patient on the radiology table. So we need to be very very conscious of what we are doing, and if we do think that maybe there is a pleural collection or pleural effusion or pneumothorax, maybe we could use an ultrasound probe just to confirm if there is any kind of effusion in the chest. And then if we do confirm the presence of effusion or pneumothorax, obviously the first step to stabilize them is to do a thoracosynthesis. There is a pleural effusion, we would need to do an exam of the effusion, physical and chemical. We will need to check the PCV. We will need to do cytology and certainly send the sample to bacteriology for cultural sensitivity. If it's a pneumothorax, we just need to drain the pneumothorax and see if eventually a chest drain will be needed in the following hours. If we do not find any pleural effusion or any pneumothorax, then we might need to consider to proceed to a CT scan. The emergencies of the upper airways, or the condition that causes emergency related to the upper airways, are most of the time obstructive. In particular, I have listed here the most frequent. So we might have to deal with the laryngeal paralysis or vocal full granulomas or BOAs, which are the most frequent ones. But we can also have neoplasias of the larynx or the trachea. We might have windpipe stenosis, or we have also, we see very frequently bile wounds of the cervical region with swelling and trachea rupture. The conditions of the lower respiratory tract are more related to presence of pleural effusions or pulmonary masses or traumatic lesions such as diaphragmatic rupture or disruption of the thoracic wall. In this presentation, I will mainly focus on the emergencies of the upper airways, and I will also mention some cases with disruption of the thoracic wall. So let's start with some practical examples. So this is Nancy Gray. She was a Jack Russell Terrier, a female, 6 years old, and she was presented as an emergency for investigation of severe respiratory distress. Let's see how the respiratory pattern, and I would like to call your attention on the stridor that you can hear. Nancy has been attacked by a second dog in the area of the neck 2 weeks before the presentation. And the owner noticed increased upper respiratory tract noises. She was exercise intolerant, and the owner realized also that she was prone to become cyanotic in more than one occasion. So, furthermore, the owner also reported that there was a change in the voice, and that actually Nancy Gray was could not bark anymore. So what we have done, she was an emergency, and as you have seen in the video, she was pretty dyspneic and with an evident stridor. So we have anesthetized her to assess the larynx and the upper airways, because the stridor is a typical sign of obstruction at the level of the larynx. So, and what we found under light general anesthesia was that she had a bilateral paralysis, and in this case Nancy was taken directly to theater for a laryngeal lateralization. So she had the laryngeal lateralization procedure done, and this is actually Nancy in our second video after the surgery. So Nancy, actually, as you can see, this is the day one post-op, and as you can see, she recovered uneventfully, and she was discharged 2 days after surgery. So Nancy Gray was a case of traumatic laryngeal paralysis, but we have also cases of idiopathic laryngeal paralysis. These mainly in elderly dogs, and we can see in the video, in this video, this is a proper emergency. So the dog is severely struggling, is collapsed, and this is one of the cases where we need to do things pretty rapidly, because we might risk to lose the patient. Equally, we have the next video. In the next video, this is Jordan, and this was a case that was handled very well by the referring vet, because this dog was living like 2 hours away from our hospital, and he had he was in respiratory distress because of laryngeal paralysis, but the vet was not in the position to do an emergency lateralization procedure. And then per telephone we gave her instructions to place a tracheostomy tube so that at least we could have bypassed the obstruction at the level of the larynx, and the dog could have been traveled to the clinic, where then we admitted and we assisted, and then he underwent also a laryngeal lateralization procedure. So laryngeal paralysis is in general a condition with different degrees of gravity. In stable patients, laryngeal lateralization can be scheduled as routine surgery. In severe cases, like the one reported in these videos, the lateralization is considered urgent and should and should be performed promptly by passing the diagnostic workup. The owners must be aware that when we do a laryngeal procedure in emergency, without doing a proper diagnostic workup, we might miss conditions like neoplasias or hypothyroidism or peripheral neuropathies, which are usually conditions related to the laryngeal paralysis. In most of the cases, when we do a proper diagnostic workup, we do not find any underlying reason, and then we say that the paralysis is idiopathic. But in some cases, as I was mentioning before, we might find a peripheral polyneuropathy or hypothyroidism or neoplasia in the spleen or in the liver. The next case is Millie. Millie was a Labrador, and actually she was scheduled as a routine appointment 2 weeks before. And in this case, the owner didn't realize how bad she was with the breathing. And in particular, I planned for her, once I admitted her, I planned her the diagnostic workup. But as we can see in the next video, as soon as we sedated her to do the diagnostic workup, she collapsed and she was not able to cope with the condition. So that instead of proceeding with a diagnostic workup, we did anesthetize her and we moved her directly into surgery to do a laryngeal lateralization. So, this just for those that are curious. So, this is what usually we do with lateralization. So, the technique I personally use is the I don't find my arrow anymore. So it's the one in the bottom right. Oh, thank you. Here is the cricoarytenoid lateralization, where we do apply suture between the cricoid and the cricoid cartilage and the arytenoid cartilage. Usually I apply just one suture, but because the room that we have at the level of the arytenoid articular process is very tiny, in some cases possible to apply two, and some surgeons do that. The other technique is similar, just that the sutures are applied between the arytenoid cartilage and the thyroid cartilage. So this is called thyroid arytenoid lateralization. So let's go to these are different cases. These are the usual brachycephalics. We are all used to see these dogs. These are two presentations. The Mabel is a French bulldog, and she was presented with this pattern of breathing, clearly indicating an upper respiratory problem, obstruction. If you look at the abdomen, how she is struggling to breathe, and she couldn't do anything. She became cyanotic. She used to become cyanotic at the minimum exercise. Whilst the next video is another Mabel, different written, and she is an English bulldog, and she was taken as an emergency again with a clear upper respiratory obstruction. So now, if we look at both individually, so we see the first one is the French bulldog Mabel, the one that we saw first, and so we need a video. Maybe we can go directly to the video number 8. I was making confusion. So this is the English bulldog, the second one that we have seen, and you see how she was not coping with the obstruction. And this was at 5 a.m. in the morning. We were inducing, the pre-oxygenation is very important. And this is the situation that we found. So basically, her soft palate was very long, elongated, and also you can see very fecund. So there is no room in this oral cavity. However, most of the bulldogs do present like that. What was the worst problem in Mabel here were the laryngeal saccules that were very prominent and completely obstructing the rima glottidis, plus the overlong and over fecund soft palate. So laryngeal collapse type 1 plus overlong and fecund soft palate, which required shortening and thinning of the soft palate and excision of the laryngeal saccules. Whilst the other Mabel, the French bulldog, let's see. Is this video not working? Let's do it again. Yes, so the one that we have seen before. The reason why she was breathing or she was obstructed was the presence of this lesion. This is a CT scan. We have a coronal view on your left side and a sagittal view on your right side. And you see, let's have a look at the sagittal view. Actually, Mabel is not too bad in terms of soft palate. The soft palate, yes, is long, but it's not even thickened. So, and we see here, this is the rhinopharynx, so the nasopharyngeal passage is pretty free. So the only reason why this dog was obstructed was the presence of this lesion, which is called vocal full granuloma. And I have here, you see the image on your bottom left and the video that you're seeing. We are at the level of the laryngeal opening. What you are seeing are the right and the left arytenoid cartilage. And this is where these lesions, one in front of the other, which are called kissing lesions. And in particular, these are granulomas, vocal fold granulomas, which build up in mainly in brachycephalic dogs. They have been described also in human beings, secondary to intubation, so traumatic intubation of the patient. But in brachycephalic dogs, the presence of this granuloma is suggestive of a recurrent gastroesophageal reflux and hiatal hernia. So basically, the granuloma forms because of the irritation due to the regurgitation and the reflux. And the way, these are difficult cases where, as you can see in this image on the top left, to be able to do any intervention at the level of the larynx, we had to do a temporary tracheostomy so that we could have room to work at the level of the larynx. And these lesions usually are removed via laser ablation. This dog in the end needed a permanent tracheostomy because she was not coping. These cases are cases where gastroesophageal reflux and hiatal hernia needs to be investigated and needs to be addressed, because if we do not control the gastroesophageal reflux, the granulomas will recur. So it's actually a never-ending cycle. This one is an interesting one. It's a young Chow Chow that was presented with a long history of stertor. And the clinical signs had recently worsened. So the problem with this dog, you know, is that their tongue is dark and sometimes difficult to see if they are cyanotic or not. This Chow Chow underwent diagnostic workup. In particular, we see here radiograph of the neck and of the abdomen. And you can see at the level of the neck, you can see this lesion, this swelling in the oropharynx, which we could see also under GA on the right side of the oropharynx. And the abdominal X-ray just shows you the aerophagia of this dog because of the open mouth breathing. So now when we anesthetize this dog, this is how the lesion presented. So by each inspiration and expiration, there was this bulging protruding mass occluding the larynx. So what to do in these cases? So actually we can see the video. I know this is after we have emptied it. Basically, we did a fine needle aspiration of the swelling, and you can see the yellowish content that we could retrieve. Basically, we have emptied the cystic lesion, and usually removal of the fluid improves the clinical signs. The cystic lesion had no anatomical connection to any cervical structure, so it was not a mucosal, for example. And in the end of our diagnosis, it was considered congenital. True congenital, the dog was a young dog. True congenital pharyngeal cysts in small animals are rare, and there is very little published information on this condition. The majority of the pharyngeal cysts are called branchial cleft retention cysts, where there is an embryological failure of epidermal tissue to involute, and the treatment is surgical. Yes, the aspiration of the fluids results in temporary improvement, as we have seen in the video, but the tendency of this structure is to recur, so they fill up again with the fluid. So basically in the end, surgical excision is the best way to deal with that. Then we have this, this is a super cute cat. You need to listen very carefully because it's not very evident. So there is a stridor. And he had a trauma like a few months before presentation. And as you can see in this radiograph, if we follow the track here, you see that here at the level of the chest inlet, there is some sort of stenosis of occlusion of the trachea. This is what is called pseudotrachea. Basically, when a tracheal avulsion occurs, or a rupture of the trachea because following a trauma, there is the tendency of the tissue to create like a granuloma of a pseudomembrane, better called a pseudomembrane, around the tear of the trachea, which keeps the continuity of the tube of the windpipe. So basically the air doesn't exit the trachea, stays within the trachea and goes into the lungs, but there is no real cartilage scaffold. It's just scar tissue at this level, which with the time tends to create a stenosis. So the resection of this segment of the trachea with the anastomosis is the treatment of choice and usually yields good results. As I was saying, it is hypothesized that this injury occurs secondary to blunt trauma, during which the neck is hyperextended. The resultant usually leads to the trauma usually leads to a circumferential rupture at the weakest point of the either of the intrathoracic trachea, where the carina is, or at the level of the chest inlet. Some severely affected patients might die because of the tearing of the trachea when it's completely. Others, most of the time, mainly cats, as I said, do tend to create this pseudomembrane, which keeps the continuity of the trachea, and this allows them to survive. But time, 2-3 weeks, a month, maybe 2 months, they do start to develop these clinical signs of tracheal stenosis, tracheal obstruction. So this little kitten that we have seen had the pseudotrachea, a pseudomembrane at the chest inlet. Here we have the sternum, and this is exactly the image, the point where we saw the tissue proliferation in the X-rays. This needs to be resected, and obviously the main problem here is how to keep the animal under anesthesia. Certainly we could do CRI, but we can, what is best is to keep them on gas, and we need in these situations a sterile tracheotube, which we will use to intubate the distal portion of the trachea whilst we are removing the segment, the affected segment. So basically we land in a situation like that. Here is the proximal trachea and this is the distal trachea with the tube, and the anesthetist is maintaining the cabin anesthesia via the system and this tube. In the meantime, we do apply stay sutures in the most distal, distally from us, so in the, I would say, in the dorsal trachea. So we apply stay suture so that we are sure that we are, we have the two segments together, and we start to suture and to do the anastomosis. And when we are at this level, we can remove the tube from the distal trachea segment, and the anesthetist can reintubate the cat orally, and then we can guide the tube down the windpipe. Okay, and then we conclude, we finish the anastomosis with simple interrupted stitches. And this, in this picture, you can see the removed the two. These are two trachea rings that we have removed. As I said, they usually do well. This is the X-ray post-op, and this is the video. So as you see, the cat is pretty chilled out, very happy, and the X-ray here we can see is really probably there is here a bit of narrowing of the trachea, but this is really not very significant. Okay, having said that, I've mentioned to the pseudotrachea and rupture of the trachea, something very important. Cases that we see very frequently are those ones where we have a cervical, a penetrating cervical wound, bite wounds, which obviously can be important emergencies. These are, as I said, very common. And most of them result from attacks by other dogs. This, for example, was a 4 years old miniature pincher. So we saw him in emergency for a bite wound to the head and the neck region. The initial assessment showed a possible collapsed trachea. Certainly, as you can see, cervical soft tissue swelling and subcutaneous emphysema. Despite the I would say pretty dramatic clinical presentation and the several bite injuries, this dog was not even in dyspnea, or he couldn't hear any stridor, which is really surprising. Let's have a look at the radiograph. If we look at the lateral radiograph of the cervical head and neck, we certainly see the severe swelling, but if you look better, if you focus on this area, you will see that there is dislocation. There is a dislocation and a fracture of the hyoid apparatus. We did also endoscopy, and the windpipe, the trachea, and the esophagus. They were unremarkable. There were no injuries at that level. The final injury was the soft tissue trauma and the damage of the hiatus, of the hyoid apparatus. We did exploratory surgery of the neck just to check the soft tissue, and the damage extended up to the cervical vertebras. With the bradied and necrotic tissue, we flashed and we placed a Penrose drain. But this dog developed a severe respiratory distress and upper airway destruction, obstruction following the surgery, so that he needed a temporary tracheostomy. Regarding the fracture and the dislocation of the hyoid apparatus, there is nothing that we could do. Usually these issues resolve and they do not require surgery. This was another one. Scooby was Jack, even if he doesn't seem Jack Russell, he was a Jack Russell Terrier, was 4 years old, and again he was presented as an emergency after being attacked by a dog the night before. According to his owner, Scooby had developed a large swelling on the left side of the neck immediately after the attack. The assessment raised the concern of a tracheal tear due to progressively worsening subcutaneous emphysema. Again, he did not show any signs of dyspnea since the attack. And the radiographs taken by the vet, the referring vet, showed gas tracking along the facial. I don't have the X-rays, apologize for this, but I can report the findings. So basically in the X-rays of the neck and chest that the referring vet took, was gas tracking along the facial plane, along the neck. He had pneumomediastinum and pneumoperitoneum. So when we have pneumomediastinum, we always have to think that there must be a lesion either in the trachea or in the esophagus or in the neck. Usually we have first the pneumomediastinum and then the pneumothorax. So this is the order in which the lesions develop. So we usually do not have a pneumothorax, which becomes a pneumomediastinum. The pneumomediastinum is the very first change, and then from the pneumomediastinum we could develop a pneumothorax. Anyway, likewise the previous dog, Scooby was not tachypneic and there was not even increased respiratory effort. He had diffuse subcutaneous emphysema, as you can see in this image. So, and then we did a bronchoscopy, a tracheoscopy, and you can see from this arrow there was a tracheal tear at the junction of the tracheal cartilage and the trachea and the trachealis muscle, and the lesion was extending around 20% of the circumference of the trachea. So in these cases, usually you do not do much surgically. These are lesions that tend to heal by themselves. What you need to do, you need to deal obviously with the emphysema, and you can certainly use this sort of bandage or vest to compress the skin so that the hair will be reabsorbed. In worst cases, you could also make some incision in the skin to allow the hair to be released. Most of these patients respond to medical management, which also include cage rest, oxygen, and eventually sedation if needed. The subcutaneous emphysema takes approximately 2 weeks to resolve. Okay, and again, the application of body stocking or vest to apply gentle pressure on the emphysema might be recommended. After having spoken about cervical penetrating injuries, then we have the big chapter of the thoracic wall trauma, which is again very common in dogs and cats and may occur as a result of either a blunt force trauma, like a motor vehicle accident or falling from high, or again after attacks by other animals. Penetrating injuries resulting from knives, projectiles, or foreign body may also be encountered. So, although the risk of damage to intrathoracic structures, you can see in this image we have a laceration of a lung lobe. I was saying, after blunt forces trauma, the risk of intrathoracic lesions is high. Surprisingly, few patients experience serious injury to the thoracic wall. So they have internal lesions, but not external lesions. Only 16% of dogs, for example, experiencing blunt force trauma in a paper were diagnosed with chest wall trauma in as consequence. So what is important here? Certainly the triage. Thoracic injury can lead to death. So we need to stabilize this patient and try to stabilize them so that we can take them to surgery. And a systemic approach to the care of the traumatized patient is what will save the life. Certainly, it's outside of the scope of this lecture to cover the ABC of the emergency care. However, as you can see in these slides of the teamwork having everything available for resuscitation is very important. So, what do you do with these cases? We have to rule out flail chest or pulmonary contusions or lacerations and diaphragmatic rupture. The skin laceration in the thoracic region should be examined for deeper wound, because maybe we might find just little punctures which are simply the tip of the iceberg, and then below these tiny punctures there are serious lesions of the muscles and the chest wall, and these deeper wounds might communicate with the pleural space. So dog bite injuries can be particularly severe because of the action of the canine teeth after they penetrate the skin, and any shaking of the victim by the attacker. With bite wounds, the skin might sometimes remain largely intact, except for a few punctures, as I was saying. Surgical exploration is always recommended. Just remember, because these patients need to be triaged and need to be stabilized, certainly we need oxygen. Better if we keep them in sternal recumbency, because they can cope better with the breathing. We might need to do an ultrasound. I would suggest to do blood gas analysis and pulse oximetry, eventually thoracosynthesis. Please remember that we might kill them if we put them on the X-ray table. So if we do want to try to do an X-ray, maybe choose the dorsoventral projection, so that you have your patient in sternal, and then with oxygen you can take an X-ray. It doesn't matter if it's not a perfect X-ray, it's just gives you some information about internal lesions. So like this one, okay? This is not perfectly positioned, is in dorsoventral, and you see this is the left side of the dog, and you can easily see the rib, the costal fracture, the subcutaneous emphysema, and obviously also here the pneumothorax. So there is certainly communication between the outside and the inside, and probably there have been also a laceration of the lung, which is causing the further leak of here. This image, I think, is very easy to be commented. The pneumothorax, if he's destabilizing our patient, should be drained percutaneously. And eventually, if it doesn't resolve, if we have to drain the pneumothorax repeatedly, so more than 3 times in 2 hours, probably this is a patient that needs a thoracostomy tube. So And sometimes you might learn to have these kind of patients with full thickness defects of the chest wall that really allow free movement of air into the pleural space. So there is a bite, and then we have like a soft tissue valve which is open during inspiration and closes during expiration, and this can lead to tension pneumothorax. If you see patients like this one in emergency, certainly this is not a dog that you take into surgery immediately. As you can see, this was seen in the night, and a colleague that was on call in the night just closed the wounds independent, even if they flushed the wound a little bit, closed it like a basic wound revision under sedation, placed the chest strains, and was managing the pneumothorax with the chest strains, because this dog had a pulmonary lesion and the pneumothorax was a continuous production of air, so he had to be drained very frequently. The alternative is to connect these dogs to a continuous suction system. Once you have stabilized the dog like that, then you can consider to do further diagnostic CT or better X-rays, and then explore surgically. Fractures of the thoracic cage require certainly copious analgesia and rest, because they compromise the respiration. Because patients are painful or sore, and are indicative probably of much underlying lung pathology. Fractures of the cranial ribs are often seen in association with severe cardiovascular trauma, and fracture of the caudal ribs are seen with cranial abdominal trauma, maybe diaphragmatic hernia, for example. The sternal recumbency, or if we place them with a flail side down, this may limit the pain and the further injury. And then another tip would be to wrap the chest. So wrapping the chest often decreases the complaints instead of stabilizing fracture. So I would not recommend to do bandages around chest with fractures, ribs fractures. This is, the next one is an image of, again, with a flail chest. Probably before we look at the video, if you see this X-ray, you see that there is an entire segment of thoracic wall which is detached. And this is what is basically the segment of thoracic wall which is detached from the rest, means that this segment moves independently from the rest of the thoracic cavity and independently from the inspiration and expiration. Let's have a look at the video. You need to look in the cranial. So we are here. Anyway, there was this part of the thoracic wall that was moving independently from the rest of the thoracic wall. So this is what we might find. We see fractured ribs. Basically, the continuity of the thoracic wall is completely destroyed, and we see deeply the lung parenchyma, which is punctured and perforated. So, which means these animals need surgical aspiration after stabilization. They need to be ventilated actively in the event that that a pneumothorax develops intraoperatively. The skin is incised over the area of greatest injury, and the soft tissues are carefully evaluated. Visibly, the vitalized tissue, including the skin, should be resected. Secondary to trauma, the ribs may be stripped of their soft tissue attachment, and we might have floating segments without adequate blood supply. And in this case, we should remove the segment of the rib that is involved. The lungs should be inspected for perforation, as I was mentioning before, and the thorax should be lavaged carefully. I would recommend to take a swab from the deep inside the chest, so that we can send it for culture and sensitivity. In this case, for example, this lung, this lung needs to be removed. So it will have a part. This dog will have a partial lung lobectomy, and then we have to reconstruct the thoracic wall. And before closing, we need to place a chest strain. This is a dog where, or a case where, I would certainly start antibiotics, so a broad spectrum of antibiotics, and then when you receive the culture sensitivity results back, then you can eventually swap to a different antibiotics. So the next video is to show you how to test if there is a leak from the lung. Basically, if you have a suspect of a perforating injury of the parenchyma, the lung parenchyma, you can just irrigate the chest, and it's just like the test of the tires of the bicycle, and you see these multiple bubbles. It's just air leak from a perforated lung lobe. Okay, and this is a case where if the lesion is very severe, we will need to do a lung lobectomy. If the lesion is a small puncture, maybe for those people who have the possibility to use a continuous suction system, so a free vase system or the communicating vases, then this could be also an option. So not to do a lung lobectomy, just to place a chest drain and to put the patient under continuous suction for 24, 48 or 72 hours. They can improve and the pneumothorax may resolve. However, if there is no improvement and the pneumothorax continues to build up, then these patients need to undergo a lung lobectomy. So let's say we have removed the lung, the affected lung, we have removed the necrotic tissue. Now we have the problem how to reconstruct the thoracic wall. So the necessity of reconstruction or stabilization of the thoracic wall really depends on the type of damage sustained. In most instances, rib fractures can be treated conservatively with bandaging or light bandaging. I just said that we need to be careful because we might create problems in the breathing if we do heavy bandages. But if we do reconstruct the soft tissue and we do give pain relief and control the problems arising from pleural fluid and pulmonary compromise. Fractured ribs may also be stabilized by securing them to intact adjacent ribs with circumcostal sutures or heavy gauge material. If multiple intercostal lacerations are present, so let's see this image on the right side, sutures may be pre-placed in a basket wave fashion in which encircling sutures alternate around cranial ribs and caudal ribs so that the sutures overlap. Large flail segments may have a spectacular appearance, and current thoughts is that respiratory problems in patients with flail chests are most commonly from underlying pulmonary trauma rather than the presence of the flail segment. In any case, if we do not manage to reconstruct the thoracic wall and there is a large segment of flail, then we might consider this kind of stabilization, okay, that I'm showing you in this slide, which involves the percutaneous fixation of the ribs with the flail segment to an external brace. We use non-absorbable sutures of an appropriate size, 2 knots or 1 PDS, for example, or proline, depending on the size of the patient. These are passed around the ribs within the flay segment and include also 1 rib cranial and caudal to the flay segment so that the flay segment can be fixed to the rest of the thoracic wall. And to explain me better, you can see here. So this is what we do. Basically, the principle is the same used for the treatment of the pectus excavatum. Basically, you create this brace with, for example, acrylate, and then you do holes with a drill, okay? And these are the holes where the sutures, so this is an image around the sternum for a pectus excavatus, but it's the same principle with rib flay segments. So you see the sutures, they go around the sternum and then they go through the holes of the brace, and then they are tight so that with knots, and this is how the patient looks like. Okay, and these stay, the brace stays for at least 4 weeks. Yes, and then there is the last few slides about the post-operative care in case of thoracic trauma. We said that a thoracic drain should be placed after all thoracotomies, so that we can evacuate the iatrogenic pneumothorax or the pleural effusion. So basically, we want to evacuate the pleural space from the blood, from the air, and from the lavage solutions that we have used. And we also need to re-establish the negative pressure. In patients that have not undergone thoracic wall reconstruction or in which respiratory or cardiovascular structures have not been opened, the thorax can be drained with a temporary catheter, either or like a butterfly, for example. So the problem is most of the time is the pleural effusion, which is the major complication after thoracic wall reconstruction or resection, and the thoracic drain should be maintained for long enough to establish whether this is likely to occur. For example, in this image you see the malar, which is a chest tube, and the red line indicates the place where we have done the lung lobectomy. This was a routine thoracotomy, and this on your left side was a dog where we had to remove a big part of thoracic wall. The pleural effusion usually develops within the first 48 hours after surgery, and the amount declines sharply within 4 to 5 days after surgery. In patients with extensive soft tissue reconstruction, such as rotating myocutaneous flap, a closed suction drain is also placed into the subcutaneous space and maintained as long as effusion persists. Failure to drain the subcutaneous space could result in migration of the seroma fluid through prostatic mesh and into the thoracic cavity. Yes, and this is a significant over interest image. So you can see this dog underwent thoracotomy. Different from, it was not a thoracic trauma, it was a thoracotomy for a PDA. Anyway, I have put this image just to introduce the concept of the early post-operative period after thoracic wall surgery or after thoracic surgery, which is a very critical period where we risk to lose the patient easily if we do not carefully monitor the vitals, the respiratory rate, the cardiovascular sequela. It's very important to provide effective pain management, because this ensures normal ventilation. Abnormal function of a reconstructed thoracic wall or lung atelectasis, hypoventilation from pain, or hypoventilation resulting from depressant medications may all result in abnormal blood gas values. Oxygen supplementation with indwelling nasal oxygen cannula or by use of an oxygen cage ensures that oxygenation, that oxygenation is adequate, while postoperative problems such as pulmonary atelectasis will resolve. Let's have a look at this slide. This is something that we could do easily intraoperatively. So we could apply local anesthesia. We can apply bupivacaine or lidocaine in the intercostal spaces where we are going to operate. So usually we do inject local in the rib, cranial and caudal where we are going into the chest. So if more than three ribs are involved, then we can apply or inject the local anesthetic in the entire thoracic wall, and we inject it caudally along. We just find the rib, we palpate the rib, we go as much as proximal as possible at the level of the junction between the vertebra and the rib, and then caudal to the rib where usually the vascular neurovascular bundle is. We do inject our local. But we can also use for pain control transdermal anesthesia, or obviously parenteral CRI, ketamine CRI, lidocaine. So we also usually recommend the use of opioids, methadone, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Just to have what we reach in this way is a multimodal analgesia plan. Obviously, there are in this last slide, there are other ways to provide analgesia in these cases. You see this slide where we can think about an epidural regional anesthesia. Or, as I was mentioning before, CRI, like ketamine. Or, again, this is an epidural catheter. And via this epidural catheter, we were injecting bupivacaine into the spinal canal to have analgesia. It was working very well. So I think this was my last slide. So I think we are on time. And obviously there is a lot to discuss about emergencies that of the respiratory tract needing surgery. So I try to give you an overview, but obviously there are other subjects that I haven't mentioned. I hope this has given you some input for the everyday management of cases, and I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any. Thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Daniela for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.